Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah.
That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. We took a little break last week to go down to the Florida Keys for the founder of Heritage Foods USA and the Heritage Radio Network, Patrick Martin, and Ann Saxelby's wedding. Really good time. And now we're back. A very lovely day in Brooklyn, New York here. And I don't even know how to get started with this show today because I have one of the most interesting people that I've met to date, Mr. Jonathan Forrester, finally in the studio. After a long time of anticipation and waiting for him to come in the studio, we got him in here, along with his really amazing and very, very old school line of spirits and bitters, the Duchess Spirits. We're going to be talking about some sugar wash moonshine, some aged peach brandy, and colonial bitters. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I have spent the last hour with you before the show, chit-chatting, hanging out, and I'm kind of blown away. We're gonna have a lot to talk about on this show today. So first of all, a new line of spirits they've just been launched.
Yes, just in the past couple of weeks.
And they're very, very like old school traditional style spirits. And you are, I want to point out, a very, very old school dude. Let's just jump in, man. You were telling me before the show that that you got into the world of spirits and wine and food at a very young age.
Yeah, that's true. My father was taking courses at NYU and Columbia for undergrad and grad school. And just for fun, he took wine courses. So he would come home and I would be 5, 6 years old. And he would teach me about wines, ask my opinions, quiz me. He would take the bottles and turn them label away. And I had to tell him what country and what type of wine they were, which nowadays it's hard to do. But back then in Europe, they had specific bottles and colors of the glass for different types of wines. By the time I was 10, 11 years old, I basically had to, whether it was French, German, Italian, Spanish, read the label of the bottle and tell him what region it was from, what type of wine it was, approximately what the flavor characteristics should be. It was a lot of fun having my father and spending time with him like that, because my parents were both immigrants, and going through school here, they always worked opposite shifts. We never saw them growing up at the same time because they didn't want babysitters. They wanted to spend time with us.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Way it should be. So you you started out tasting wines and just from the palate and the nose picking these things out, varietals and different regions, and that eventually over a period of time.
Yeah.
Which we're gonna have a I hate to do this to our listeners, but we're going to have like a whole series on you. We can't fit it all in one show. That's definitely a good thing. You've definitely been a renaissance man as far as just living life and traveling around, and especially with food and beverage. And you told me before the show that you've basically lived in, you said, 8 states.
Yep.
And
5 different regions of the country.
5 different regions of the country.
And traveled. I've been to 46 of the states.
Wow. I've been to 2. Oklahoma and New York. And Florida.
Florida, hey.
3. I got 3 under my belt. So, after being introduced at a very young age to the world of food and beverage. You said you were cooking and you were checking out these different wines. What started leading you into the spirits world?
I was working as a food and beverage consultant, and I started writing about first about food and simple things like wine 101. So I was writing online for slashfood.com, which at the time was considered the number one professional food blog in the world. I'd won that for many years. And I started getting into spirits, because once you're a writer, you start getting samples in the mail, and all of a sudden I'm tasting all these things and writing about them. And I found that the wines I really enjoyed, but spirits, there was so much going on a different level. And then cocktails, the fine cocktails, the crafted cocktails were starting to become really big. And I started going to events and tasting cocktails, and even submitted some recipes of my own to different people, different companies. And they were like, hey, we tried this. This is really good. Can we put it on our website? Or would you like to be in our competition? Things like that. So it was kind of a snowball effect.
Yeah. Let's talk about the botanicals for these spirits. I mean, like we said at the top of the show, you've got your sugar wash moonshine, you've got your aged peach brandy, which is extremely old school and really cool. We haven't had a real peach brandy on the market, and that's one of your motives for producing these mm-hmm. different spirits, is because obviously with the culinary and cocktail renaissance coming back around, there are a lot of, you know, when you read all these old cocktail books, you see a lot of ingredients mm-hmm. in these recipes and specs that you're like, what the hell is that? Peach brandy? Like, okay, that sounds simple enough. I could go like get Marie Brizard, you know, like peach brandy, but it's not a real peach brandy.
Right. It's a peach cordial liqueur as opposed to a brandy made from peaches.
Yeah. And it's usually like a liqueur mixed with a cheap brandy or something like that.
Yeah, you know, or neutral spirit.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So, and then also with the colonial bitters, mm-hmm. we've got some ground to cover with the botanicals. I mean, like, we know that, you know, Fernet Branca controls 70% of the world's saffron market, mm-hmm. and Benedictine has their hand down on the Angelica seed. You know, mm-hmm. how did you come around to? I mean, another thing that you were telling me before the show is that you have 215 herbal tinctures.
Right, my botanical library.
Yeah.
Over the years, I've been laying my hands on every time I hear of a new botanical, I make a tincture out of it. Part of it goes back to I have a hobby of foraging for wild edible and medicinal plants. I worked out in the wilderness for many years. And so I had tasted a lot of interesting herbs, botanicals, that the average person hadn't. And I wanted to put out bitters. And for years, I hemmed and hawed and said, oh, okay, this is going to be a flash in the pan. But now, bitters in all their different variations are here to stay. But I want to put out one that was really good. So I have been collecting all these bitters, making tinctures, and tasting them and seeing what the flavor and aroma profiles are. And I wanted to make this bitters just to see if I could. And so about a year ago, I started researching, and I wanted to come up with bitters that we call them colonial bitters, our Dutch's colonial cocktail bitters, but they aren't made how bitters were back then to that taste profile. Instead, I looked at the flavors and spices, aromas, and perfumes of the 1700s, and some of the ingredients that were used then, like Angelica seed, which isn't used as a spice anymore, beefeater, gin, has Angelica seed in it, the Benedictine liqueur, and between them they probably take up, you know, the majority of the world market. I didn't know that at the time, and I just liked the flavor of the Angelica seed and saw that it was very popular back then. So I looked at other ingredients, ones that like the Native Americans had introduced the colonists to. One of them is called spice bush, which is a wild bush. It's never really been grown commercially. I knew about it from the wilderness, how fantastic herb tea it made from the leaves and twigs and the berries, just the incredible. They called it American allspice back then. It's actually much more complex than allspice, with a lot of black pepper and juniper notes, as well as all these other spice flavors. And so I got together a list of about 20 different things that were popular in the flavor aromas back then, and picked which ones I thought would play well off of each other. And so having this huge library, I was able to go through and say, okay, this works, this doesn't. Put together a prototype, and I was like, something's missing here. But there was a Indian Native American ingredient called kinnik-kinnik, which the word means mixture, and they used kinnik-kinnik anytime they were making a mixture for cooking spices, medicinals, or their smoking mixtures that they would use for their ceremonies. They always used kinnik-kinnik because they felt it brought everything together. And so for the heck of it, I threw some kinnik-kinnik in there, and I was like, wow, this is working.
It was like the bitters for the bitters.
Yep.
It was like the thing that brought everything together.
Exactly.
Cool.
So
let's jump into the foraging thing for a second, because I think that's extremely fascinating. I had the great opportunity to attend a seminar maybe like almost a year ago, I guess. It was last spring, early summer. And Nick Strangeway
was talking
about, of course, you know, he was talking about foraging. He did a whole seminar on foraging for different ingredients in Central Park.
Okay. Yeah.
And
was that at the Gin Symposium?
It was right before that.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was just fascinating because he came back and he was talking about like growing your own ingredients, like even in New York City, like, growing your own herbs and botanicals, you know, wherever you can. Basically, you know, on your fire escape.
Yep.
Or if you're lucky enough to even have a fire escape in New York City. Or on your windowsill. And a lot of these ingredients were kind of, like, not necessarily, like, rare. It was like lemon balm and like hyssop and stuff like that. But it was really interesting to see a lot of these bartenders who were at the seminar come around and be like, oh shit, man, I can grow my own botanicals and mix them up together. And obviously, like, anytime you're making like bitters or any kind of like tincture, there's a lot of trial and error.
Oh, definitely.
And I love that you have 215 different tinctures at home to where you can actually mix and match and really pinpoint a flavor profile for any of these.
Yeah.
Like, for me, it's like, I'm like, oh, well, I make a Buddha's hand bitters. I'm going to throw some allspice in there. I'm going to throw quassia bark because I like the way it tastes, you know. But you actually have access to so many different profiles that it must have been really, like, a lot of fun coming up with these bitters. And then also these spirits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it wasn't done all at once. It's been over a few years, so otherwise 215 sounds overwhelming. The peach brandy is the first product I want to make. I had been on different discussion boards, Chanticleer Society, and some of the other cocktail boards, and I kept seeing again and again, peach brandy, where's peach brandy? Where's real peach brandy? And I, at the time, was a partner in a winery up in Maine. We opened up a brewery came on board to help open up the brewery, and we were going to have a small distillery. And I mentioned on discussion board, does anyone have any information on this peach brandy, exactly how it was made? And it was a farmhouse product, and each farmhouse would make it themselves with whatever leftover peaches they had, and, you know, as a way of making money. So peach brandy was actually the number two spirit drunk in the 1700s and 1800s in America. You would just go to your local farmer who you liked his product and pick up a small barrel, and it would be unaged at the beginning of the year, and by the time it was almost empty, it would be very aged. But with Prohibition, all of these farmhouse distilleries, because every town basically in America had a small distillery, and because it was a value-added product for the farmers, a way to make extra cash.
Sure.
So the three generations basically lost the knowledge and taste about peach brandy. Lem Motlow, who was Jack Daniels' nephew who took over, loved peach and apple brandy, and actually had a special still in the distillery where he made it for himself. 1940 to 46, he put apple and peach brandy back on the market. It just didn't work, and that was basically the last time it was sold commercially. I'm a member of the American Distilling Institute. I help administer their online discussion forums for artisanal distillers, and at conferences I mentioned to other distillers, hey, put out a peach brandy if you can. And Two people did, very, very limited amounts, very expensive. It's a very expensive product to make, and really not available. So I said, you know, okay, I want to make this. And finally, the distillery up in Maine, we never got it opened. I came back to New York, and I started working on projects and got a great business partner, financial person for this Dutch's Spirits that we're starting. And I said, you know, I want to make this product. So basically, I supplied the peach, and he supplied the money for going into a winery and making it. And we made this peach brandy, which I'm pleased with. It's aged 3 to 6 months. It was distilled out different ways. I used different techniques. So part of it is a blend of a peach eau de vie. Part of it is more pot distilled. Some of it was aged in charred barrels. Some of it in toasted barrels. And some of it unaged, because I wanted to bring in a broad spectrum of flavors. And, you know, back in the 17 and 1800s, you know, every single peach brandy was different because there's different stills and different ways they made it. And I wanted to get something that was just kind of a blend of everything that could have possibly been back then. And this is the product that's just coming on the market right now. We have a few that came out the past couple of months.
And it's really cool. I mean, like, but we were talking about before the show, even, it's, I mean, I like the idea of blending them because of what you were saying about, like, having it in a barrel, pulling from that first sip, and then by the time it gets to the end of the barrel, you've got a more aged product.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that it has, like, has a real, like, eau de vie, like, it's got just enough heat, you know, mm-hmm. to make it not so, like what we're used to, which is a peach liqueur.
Right.
It's a spirit.
Yeah.
It's a real spirit.
I mean, it's a brandy made from peaches. There's no added sugar. There's no coloring. It's just the flavor that came through. Part of the big flavor profile is because we used a mash or puree that's the whole peach, not a wine. So it went through the whole fermentation process and distillation process as thick as, you know, pudding. And that's, you know, why the intensity of the flavor comes through so strong, that and the natural sugars that's transferred over.
It's delicious. It's, you did a really good job on this one.
Thanks.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm sure we will continue to drink more peach brandy and sugar wash moonshine. We'll be right back with Jonathan Forrester.
Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we'd love to tell their stories. New Chocolates in Brooklyn offers delicious and classic combination truffles and caramels, sweet, salty, some even with beer. Using single-origin cocoa beans, production takes place right in their shop on Atlantic Avenue. Come have a taste in one of our 6 Manhattan locations.
And we are back. Listening to the Speakeasy? We've got Jonathan Forrester in the studio. We got a little sidetracked during the break because we were enjoying this amazing peach brandy so much. Jonathan, tell us a little bit more about, like, the inspiration behind Dutch's Spirits.
Okay, Dutch's Spirits, spelled DUTCH'S. Well, it's up in Pine Plains, New York, near Rhinebeck, hour and a half north of the city. It's a 400 to 500 acre farm. The original name, Harvest Homestead Farm, presently owned by the Adams family. And
Not to be confused with the show.
Right. direct descendant, as far as I know, from the president, John Adams. And Alex Adams, in college, met Ariel Schlein. He is the president of Dutch's Spirits. And over the years, they became good friends. And then Ariel was invited up to the farm and found that there were all these secret underground tunnels and bunkers and stuff. And basically, it seems that the gangster Dutch Schultz financed an underground bootleg distillery on the property back in 1930s. I was approached by them to come on board as consultant and distiller, and, you know, for production, creating products, helping getting them onto market. And I looked at the business plan and I said, okay, I got to go look at this place. And we went up to the farm, and it blew me away. This was 2 years ago, exactly 2 years ago. And we pull up and they move aside some boards that are hiding up a small hole in a wall that's about, 3 foot by 3 foot. And I stick my head in, and there's a 4 foot by 4 foot concrete tunnel. that stretches out, and I see it makes a turn, and I don't know where it goes, and you know, I crawl in and look with the flashlight, and there's over 600 feet of these concrete tunnels on the property.
Wow.
And huge underground bunkers, what were part of the sub-basement of a three-story barn back during Prohibition. And there was an ex-New York City police officer called Patrick Ryan, who no one knows exactly where he got his money, but because of the underground bunker nature of the thing, which Dutch Schultz definitely, that was one of his trademarks, was having escape tunnels and stuff. And the fact of verbal stories told and research that was done later and newspaper articles, we're pretty sure Dutch Schultz. So it's probably also the original Dutch Landgraf. We're in Dutchess County, so that's how we came up with the name of Dutch's Spirits.
Yeah.
I did some research. I said, okay, I'm hearing stories about this, but I want to find out the reality. And I went online and I went into archives, and I actually found several newspaper articles from 1932 saying still seized in Pine Plains, October 17th, 1932, on the third attempt at a raid by the feds, they finally found the hidden distillery. I mean, twice everything was hidden so well that the feds didn't find anything.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And they knew there were eight people there on the property. And when they finally raided, two people who were laborers who didn't even speak English were captured. So we know the escape tunnels worked, that six of them got away. Patrick Ryan, whose the farm was in his name, never got held accountable for anything. You know, he was a retired New York City cop, supposedly a fingerprint expert at the time. Well, you know, how is a cop going to have enough money to buy a 500-acre farm? What was it? $25,000 worth of equipment.
So was somebody listed. Was greasing his palm.
Yeah. I mean, it was in today's scale, it would be over $400,000 worth of equipment. And it was a huge distillery. Put it this way, two 2,000-gallon stills were there. Now, that 2,000-gallon still, we're looking at the distillery we're building now. And if we are at peak production with two different permits, making 70,000 proof gallons a year, our stills are one quarter the size. So they were producing somewhere around 700 or 800 gallons a week of moonshine. They had, when the feds seized the place, there was something like 13,000 or 15,000 gallons of moonshine in tanks, like 10,000 pounds of sugar. I don't have the articles in front of me that list exact numbers or anything. The farm had great history after that too, over the years. During World War II, group of Germans who were worried about the possibility there might be internment camps for Germans, like what later happened on the West Coast, the Japanese bought it as sort of a commune co-op thing, and they built 15 or 20 homes, and they had there was a huge bunkhouse that with 10 bunk rooms in it, and eventually passed on to other hands until it ended up in the Adams hands back in 1960s.
And I love stories like this because it was such a, especially coming from you, like talking to you earlier, like you're kind of, I really wish we would have been recording the entire conversation before we even went on the air, because you're kind of a crazy dude. you've kind of done all this wild shit. And especially for you to be working with this distillery, like, those stories, to me, are some of the most fascinating. Actually, they're really the reason, one of the main reasons why I started getting into this whole world of spirits and cocktails. And it's mainly like this very rich history. And to have, New York City cop with his name on a property in a distillery.
Mm-hmm.
And, these are great stories.
Yeah.
These are really great stories. And it just adds more life, more richness to the history of these things. And, shit, man. Like, I constantly think about it, like, especially, like, with... I'm not a big fan of NASCAR. I'm actually not. But that's, like, where... Like moonshining.
Right. NASCAR came out of moonshine.
Yeah, exactly.
The bootleggers.
Just running. Rum running. And basically, like, especially like what you have here, the next thing we're going to taste on the show here is the Sugar Wash Moonshine, which is essentially it's kind of a rum in a way. It's like a cachaça.
Kind of like a white rum cachaça, sugar eau de vie.
Yeah, which is really cool. And you said you use turbinado and demerara.
Yep. Sugar in the raw, turbinado, sugar. Okay, the reason I made this, we wanted to just have a novelty thing that might only be sold out of the distillery. We were playing around with it, and I looked at the newspaper articles from 1932, and it described everything that was found there, and there was no trace of grain mentioned. And back during Prohibition, and even to present day, Mid-Atlantic and New England moonshine production came from more of a rum background. Rum is anything made from cane, sugar cane. It listed, how many thousands of pounds of sugar there were. And, there was a case of toasted oak chips, so they may have been a part of it trying to age it. But mostly, the product had to be a sugar-washed moonshine, which means it's 100% sugar and water and yeast fermented into basically a white rum-style wash and then distilled. Well, you can make a very fine product like that, but I decided instead of white sugar to go with something that had a lot more flavor to it.
A little bit more body, richness.
Exactly, so the turbinado sugar. And then I used a Caribbean rum yeast. I wanted to bring flavor in, but we also wanted it to be a white spirit and light in flavor and approachable. So we took it all the way up to a neutral spirit and then brought it down. And people see sugar wash moonshine and this funky, cool moonshine style bottle that it's in, and they're scared. They're like, oh, this is going to be harsh and rich. But I don't know. Why don't you describe?
Really pleasant. It's really pleasant. And would you say that something like this is kind of more along the lines of like the traditional, like something you might find back in the mid 1800s, even like going further back, like Triangle Trade days.
No, I would say this was a product that pretty much started in Prohibition, because before that it was really a rum. They were using molasses and water.
Oh yeah, sure.
So I would say that historically this probably started right at the beginning of Prohibition as the cheapest way you can make a decent quality spirits. And most people think of moonshine as this harsh, horrible stuff, but these guys were out to make money. You don't get repeat customers by making lousy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like that's true. That is very true. But also, it's Prohibition. People are trying to get their hands on whatever they could.
That's true too.
but yeah, I mean, like this one actually to me has more of a, I mean, and in no way I'm trying to like criticize this at all, because I really like this product. But to me, it's like definitely a more refined version. And we were talking about what we were talking about before the show. You were saying that a lot of times during Prohibition, people were, or even going back to the 1700s and the 1800s, a lot of these products that were being distilled were actually pretty high quality, rather than what a lot of people have. You were saying there's a common misconception with that, especially during Prohibition too, because we all think about like the fact that a lot of the cocktails, especially even like with the progression of the old fashioned cocktail, muddling fruit in rather than like what is actually called a whiskey cocktail, muddling fruit in and adds some seltzer and everything to mask the bad flavors of the cheap whiskey. But what you were saying before is that there was actually some really high quality products coming out.
Sure, I mean if you're a farmer and you are making a value added good by taking peaches that are so ripe that they're going to rot if you don't do something good with them, and turning it into brandy, you have the same people coming back year after year to buy your product if it's a good product. So, sure, I'm positive there's a lot of rot gut, cheaply made stuff out there. But, hey, George Washington was a distiller. And he made peach brandy, and he made, whiskey. As a matter of fact, at the Mount Vernon Distillery, where they're recreating George Washington's distillery, their first product out was whiskey. But their second one, a year ago, they put peach brandy into barrels. If the president is making a lousy product, that would surprise me.
Yeah, well, he's our leader. I just put some of the Dutch's colonial bitters into the sugar wash moonshine, and I got to say, it's a really nice room temperature old fashioned, as it turns out. And Jack's going to have one after the show. So tell us a little bit about the Dutch's Colonial Bitters.
Oh, I covered a lot of that before when I spoke about how I came about with it and everything. But as
far as like where we're able to find these products.
Ah, okay, yes. Right now, we're basically in New York, New Jersey, with Gotham Artisanal, who handles a lot of very fine.
They do like sodas. They do some syrups, and they're handling the employees only stuff, like you were talking about on the show.
Yeah.
Some of the other,
and then online cocktailkingdom.com. Mm-hmm. Just dropped off 10 cases there earlier today of the bitters. They are fantastic at any type of the cocktail associated products, whether it's bitters or fantastic barware, Japanese and German high quality.
I love it. I go there when I'm feeling down.
Yeah,
I go buy some gold bar tools.
Yeah. Yep, Greg Boehm. I mean, he started out as a book publisher and
children's books,
yeah. But he was a cocktail enthusiast and collected antique books, and he did reproductions exactly to the binding and color and type face of these antique books. Yeah, and then branched out into the barware. So online, cocktailkingdom.com, and I see you.
I have one in my bag right now.
Yeah,
the Robert Vermeer book. So right now, it's basically being distributed obviously, you've only been doing this for a couple of weeks now.
Yeah, the bitters have been out. We released them at Tales of the Cocktail officially last July. We didn't do any advertising or anything on it. Small company just started. I mean, we're micro-artisanal. Yes, down the road, we'll be much larger. But right now, we're still in construction of our facilities up on the farm and won't be finished until later this year. Got some really good press in the holidays. SeriousEats.com said best bitters 2011. Food and Wine Magazine, which, they're the top. Jim Meehan of PDT, which was voted one of the top cocktail bars in the world, and he was voted one of the best bartenders in the world a year or two ago, happens to be one of the editors, and he picked it, the Dutch's Colonial Cocktail Bitters, as one of his five favorite gifts. So we got a lot of really good press that just came about, and Gary Regan, top cocktail writer and expert, all of a sudden on Facebook goes,
he stopped off his beard, and they put it on top of his head,
right? he said, I stopped using Angostura bitters, and Dutch's Colonial Cocktail Bitters is all I use. And for him to say that on Facebook, it's I don't know how many thousands of friends he has, did wonders for the sales and people. We get cocktail recipes now every now and then mailed to us. Said, oh, this is in this bar here and this bar there. And a friend of mine who's a brand ambassador took bottles to India and Asia and all that. So now every now and then we get a photo on a bar sitting with a bunch of other bitters in some way off places, Dutch's bitters hanging out with their bitter friends.
Awesome. I'll have to submit some of my recipes to you.
Oh, definitely.
Can't tell you how much I've enjoyed having you in the studio today. And also, I can't really tell you how much I've enjoyed you bringing a bunch of these spirits by.
Sure, glad to.
Jonathan Forrester, you have to come back.
Sure thing.
You have to be a regular guest on this show. In fact, you should have your own show because we didn't touch enough ground with this show today. But I really appreciate you coming by and bringing these lovely spirits. What's the website?
It's DutchessSpirits.com. That's www.DutchessSpirits.com.
Excellent. Look for Jonathan Forrester around. He's one of the most interesting people you'll ever get a chance to talk to. I'm Damon Bolte. We'll see you next week. Cheers.
Take it easy, folks.
Man, he's high. I said that cat is high. Yes, he's high. Man, he's higher than a kite.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.